Hello and welcome to the Human Events Cycling Podcast. My name is Lionel Burney and I'm joined by Daniel Freed.
Hi Lionel. No Richie today. No Lionel Richie.
Where is he? Come on, the obvious gag.
Caribbean Queen, you think of Billy Ocean?
That's right, Richard's away for a few weeks.
What was the obvious gag?
Is it me you're looking for?
Sorry.
I've not been listening. Yeah, so Richard's away for a few weeks on a working holiday. So we're holding the fort. We will hear from Richard a little bit later in today's podcast. We've got a packed podcast. Daniel, we are in London, not far from Channel 4's headquarters. Why is that? Where are we off to later?
We are going to the premiere, or certainly a first screening of the Marco Pantani documentary. It's not really a biopic, is it? And very much looking forward to that. Yep.
Yeah, we're having a pre-cinema drink before heading off there. In this week's podcast, we'll be reflecting on the start of the classic season proper, with Milan-San Remo having just happened, and all the attention is now moving across to Gent-Wevelgem. We'll be hearing from Geert Van Bont, the Garmin Sharp sports director, who won that race in the year 2000. We've also got an interview with Andy Hood from Velo News, and he's got some quite interesting stuff to say about Carlos Betancourt and the Colombians, and also the state of Spanish cycling at the moment. And we will announce the winner of our competition, which was to win a signed Garmin Sharp jersey, signed by all of the riders who recently rode Paris-Nice.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
But first up, Richard and Daniel here, they watched Milan-San Remo over the weekend, and this is their thoughts on the opening classic of the season.
We've just watched Milan-San Remo, a race won by Alexander Kristoff. Probably the first Norwegian victory, we reckon.
Yeah, he's beaten Wassenhagen and Hushov to become the first Norwegian to win a monument.
Good point. You're hurting a little bit because you had sort of inside information that Kristoff was the man to watch about a month ago.
Yeah, it actually all occurred at the Katusha team presentation at the end of January in Koblenz in Germany. And at the end, there was a factory tour, a Canyon factory tour. And then in the evening, there was a kind of gala dinner. And I got onto the bus, which was taking us to the gala dinner. I happened to sit next to, or just actually in the seat in front of Kristoff and one of his teammates. I think it was Danny Moreno. Anyway, they were talking about what they'd been doing over the winter, how their families were, etc., and also their race programs. And what followed was a 15-minute monologue from Kristoff about how he was definitely going to win Milan-San Remo because, he talked about having done it in the past and having felt not obviously better after 290 kilometres, but he felt pretty much the same as he would feel after 100 kilometres. Any great decrease in his power output and the amount of watts that he was able to put out in a sprint. So he was very, very confident. And I think bookmakers were quoting him about 100 to 1 a few weeks ago.
Some people did take up your advice and are considerably better off at the moment than you are.
Yeah.
What was impressive, though, looking back, was how decisive, how committed and how confident his team were, actually. The race was a sprinter's race, as many predicted, with the Pompeiana and the Lemagne climbs missing. So we only had the Cipressa and the Poggio at the end. And so it reverted back to the race that we saw sort of pre-2008, when it often was quite a big group. The weather was an important factor. It was cold, it was wet. I think that probably had an influence on the sprint. There were a few riders, Mark Cavendish notably, who just didn't seem to have that fifth gear when they needed it. But one thing, looking back on the race, which was very impressive, very notable, was the commitment made by Katusha. They were the team that really took it on the final hour of the race, weren't they?
Yeah, it was almost a triple whammy from them, because they set the pace on the Capi, the three sort of small climbs that precede the Cipressa, and made it hard there. And this is the thing about Milan-San Remo, you don't really realise what damage has been done until the sprint, do you? It's not as though sprinters are being spat out the back all the time. It's just they are remaining with the main group or the front group, but they're getting more and more tired. So Katusha helped to tire some of the sprinters by setting a fast pace on the Capi. Then Luca Paolini attacked on the Poggio again, sort of
as predicted by somebody.
And
Yeah, we'll have sort of sapped some of the juice from some of the sprinters' legs there, and then that all allowed Christoph to just sit on in the middle of the bunch and wait for the sprint. And really, Rich, I don't know about you, but I thought that he was the only one who really looked like he had any kind of zip in his legs in the sprint. He won it quite easily.
It was a muted sort of finale. On the Cipressa, we saw Vincenzo Nibali have a go. On the Poggio, really, nobody really showed anything. Philippe Gilbert had a little go, but it wasn't the Philippe Gilbert of a couple of years ago. It wasn't his sort of... I mean, it was almost embarrassing, really, his attack. Yeah. It got him absolutely nowhere, barely opened a gap. And there wasn't a lot else. And, you know, you can be too hard on riders because in that kind of cold, it really does sap the strength and take that zip away. But it was a fairly muted affair right to the end. You know, the finish came all of a sudden, seemingly. And we expected also somebody to perhaps take a flyer, if not on the descent. Greg Van Avermaet had a little go there. Then even on the streets, you know, in San Remo coming towards the finish. Nobody did, though.
No. And, you know, it's interesting, we've talked about how major tours have changed a lot over the past few years, sort of the understanding being that it's a lot cleaner. And, you know, you see a race like San Remo today, which reverted to the pre-2008 route, pretty much. A slight change in the finish from Via Roma is no longer the finish line, but it's pretty much that route. And, you know, we've... In our memories, in our minds, there were all those sort of powerful attacks that we saw with people like Bettini on the Poggio and on the Cipressa, and you know, we saw, and you know, other guys, sort of Gabriele Colombo in 1996 on the Cipressa, etc. And we sort of expected that if someone was going to attack, we expected that today. But what actually we see now is in a race that's so long, the obstacles don't have to be that daunting for it to become a real
war of attrition, yeah.
Which is what it was. I mean, okay, you look at the top 10 today and it was predominantly sprinters, but they were all sprinters who were an absolute shadow of their usual selves.
It's not a normal sprint, is it? It's not like the end of a flat stage of the Tour of the Giro.
No.
I mean, Mark Cavendish, you know, coming over the top of the Poggio, he was better placed than he was in 2009 when he won it. He had a couple of teammates there, but they didn't seem to be really... He lost a couple of teammates as well. Mark Renshaw and Mikhail Kwiatkowski, both potentially strong allies in the finish. He did have a couple of teammates there, but they didn't seem to be fully committed to him in the way that Katusha were for Christoph.
No.
That was our impression. It's hard to tell sometimes, but that was certainly the impression.
Yeah, I mean, they did a decent job of sort of setting the pace as the group came off the Poggio make sure that no one like Cancellara or Sagan, who happened to be on a very bad day, it seemed to me, and no one sort of took a flyer. But I mean, I was just surprised generally at how quickly teams lost their pieces today. You know, Giant, Shimano were non-existent in the race. They were just not a factor.
John Degenkolb punctured, I think, on the Poggio, on the approach to the Poggio, so he was out the reckoning.
Yeah.
One of the favourites gone.
Yeah. Even prior to that, they, you know, were kind of... You would have almost expected them to play the same role as Katusha and Cannondale and make the race hard on the Cipressa, because you would imagine that Degenkolb was a much stronger climber than Cavendish. But, you know, other teams as well, that there weren't many that were well represented in that final group. Even Cannondale... You know, Cannondale did what we expected them to do. They went hard on the Cipressa, but really, well, they
one rider, the Marquee,
yeah, they really
Alexander
suffered.
Marquee was the
because
only rider.
They had one rider, yeah. And which was a bit of a surprise, and you know, because they weren't a team that was going to hedge their bets. They knew they had one strategy, one captain, and that was what they were going to. Really, they could have picked an entire team just for the Cipressa in a way, and go hard over there, get rid of all the people they needed to get rid of. But they had only De Marquee in it. Sort of penalised Sagan in the end, I think.
Yeah, Sagan was a bit of a mystery. I mean, Sagan was 10th, boxed in a bit in the finish, but he clearly didn't. He wasn't on the top of his game today. Gerald Schielek, the defending champion, was 9th. Sascha Modolo was 8th. Those three kind of strong sprinters. Mark Cavendish, 5th. He got himself into great position. He was far back coming under the kite with a kilometre to go. It looked like he was too far back. It was at a point in the race when André Greipel was just getting back on as well, and it was obviously there was too much for him to do. But Cavendish got himself into great position, and he got himself into such a position where we've seen him just step on the gas and go. And he went to do that today, and there was nothing there. You almost saw his legs just freeze and muscles not work really, while Christoph romped to victory. And Ben Swift third. I mean, Fabian Cancellara second, certainly not a sprinter. I mean, Cancellara notoriously isn't a good sprinter. So the fact that he was second perhaps attests to what a kind of slow motion sprint it was in a way.
Yeah, although I mean, I think Cancellara is underestimated as a sprinter. The French often trot out.
Paris-Roubaix sprinted well last year, didn't he?
Yeah, and the French often trot out the statistic of how fantastic he was as a sort of flying kilo. Right, see, there's me talking about the track.
a lot of it came down to positioning as well. And you know, he was in the right position. He was very annoyed not to win, actually. Ben Swift, third. He rode very, very well. That wasn't a surprise that he popped up at the end, because he'd ridden well on the Cipressa as well, which was. That was ridden quite hard, you know, and he was well positioned all the way up there, third wheel behind Sagan.
I mean, I think, you know, if you go back 4 or 5 years at the start of Ben Swift's career, we probably had several conversations about Milan-San Remo being the absolute perfect race for Ben Swift at that time. And he sort of lost his way a little bit, mainly due to circumstances beyond his control.
With a lot of injuries,
But you know, he certainly has the profile of a very, very good San Remo rider. Hopefully he'll be able to get through the season.
He spent a year in 2012 trying to make the team pursuit team for the Olympics, which I felt was an error on his part. He didn't make the team, but he lost a road season then, and then he lost last year to injury. So he's had a couple of lost years, really. A brilliant ride, not just a sort of lucky finish there, but a brilliant ride throughout the race. I thought he rode very well indeed.
Yeah, and it just kind of bears out what we were saying about it being a war of attrition more than a sprinter's classic. I mean, I think it is that much more than, for instance, Paris-Tours. Okay, Paris-Tours is slightly shorter and it's even flatter, and we do think of that as a sprinter's classic, but we also say that about Milan-San Remo at times, and it's really not that. I mean, I think this is going to be the last San Remo of this kind, because I think the Pompeiano will be in the race.
Will Cavendish, you know Cavendish very well, Daniel, will Cavendish be happy or very disappointed with that?
I mean, I spoke to him briefly a few weeks ago, literally the day when they announced that, or it wasn't even announced yet, it was the first time it had been reported that the Pompeiano was not going to be in the race, and he was a little bit dismayed at that, because he realised that the pressure would now be on him to, you know, train for San Remo and probably be the team captain there. And I think he felt that it was a bit, you know, it was a bit unfair. It was asking too much to get ready in such a short space of time. And I think that he's a little bit undercooked, to be honest. I don't think he had a terrible winter, but I don't think he had his best winter. And I think he is some way short of his best form.
Given which, a pretty decent performance then. To ride, he was not in danger of getting dropped, as he was, in fact, in 2009. You know, on the Poggio, it was touch and go over the top there, whether he was going to stay with the group, really. This time he looked fairly comfortable, whereas someone like André Greipel, who often survives on these claims, actually was tailed off.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was a triumph and a testament to Cavendish's resolve, probably. I mean, you might say we haven't spoken to him, we haven't heard what he's had to say after the race. He might say that he had fantastic legs, but I suspect he did what he did today mainly on determination and just grit.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
Well, the most noteworthy thing about Milan-San Remo is Daniel failing to back his own punt there. Could have had quite a few £100 if you backed your own hunch. You had the inside knowledge from the Katusha team launch earlier this year, and you inexplicably put your money on other horses. Why was that?
Not for the first time, mate. Well, I've been inundated with messages of thanks. I've had bottles of champagne, puppies arriving on my front doorstep this morning, judging by which, people did quite well off that, but I certainly didn't. I didn't stake a single dime on Alexander Christoph, but I have learned my lesson, and I've got some names in mind for the forthcoming classics.
Excellent. Well, I I put all my money on Mark Cavendish. Well, not all my money, but I put some money on Mark Cavendish. Sean Kelly mocked me for that, saying that John Degenkolb was absolutely nailed on for Milan-San Remo, and it just didn't turn out like that at all, did it?
No, that reminds me, Lionel, when you said I staked all my money on Mark Cavendish. There was a year, Tour de France, I think it was 2006, when, and this was before a lot of the bookmakers, I think, really understood professional cycling, and someone was quoting a price of 6-1, I think, for Frank Schleck to finish in the top 10 of the Tour de France. And I came within about 10 yards in a high street bookmaker of putting my whole student loan on it. and I wouldn't have won.
Well, yeah, that was a 2006 tour, because I backed Floyd Landis back in sort of early June at some ridiculous price.
I think he was 50-1.
He was 50-1, yeah. And I heard that he was in trouble with the dope testers, and I cashed out as quickly as I possibly could. Terribly unethical of me, but I did take the money.
Same with me and Bernhard Kohl in 2008. We should probably move on from this conversation.
Indeed. Well, listen, we're going to hear now from Andy Hood, the European correspondent for Velo News. I caught up with him at Paris-Nice recently, which Carlos Betancourt was winning, and I asked him what he knows about the latest Colombian climbing sensation.
The first time that he kind of got on my radar screen was last year at the Vuelta País Vasco, when he was a hilltop finish, kind of similar to what we saw in Paris-Nice. And he just kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, he'd been bouncing around. He won the Giro, baby Giro. He had, his runner-up in the World Championship, C23, 2009. But, a young guy has this kind of a skill set. It's pretty, quite engaging, really. He's a sprinter. He can climb. He's punchy. But he's also very savvy. And I think that's what we saw even last year, and more so. He's kind of one of those riders that has a nose to win. They can just, pull it out of the bag sometimes. And it's a combination of strength and a little bit of some mind strength as well.
Physically on the bike, he doesn't look dissimilar to Rigoberto Urán, another Colombian rider now with Amiga Pharma Quickstep. And they're quite similar in sort of riding style as well. They were both up there in the Giro last year. Betancourt was fifth overall. But then he was 126 or something in the Vuelta, which was his other big race last year. What was the reason, do you think, for such a huge sort of swing in results there?
Yeah, he got sick last year, evidently. Coming into the Vuelta last year, he was saying how he was overcoming an illness and he wasn't able to train properly as he had hoped. And I also think that, he came off the Giro last year and he has a tendency to gain weight really fast. So I think a combination of being sick and maybe just going back home and eating some mama's cooking in Colombia, I think added up against him.
And he's come back to this to Europe for this start of this season, and he made the comment in the press conference yesterday about being a little bit overweight still. It's obviously when he gets down to his fighting weight later on, I gather he's going to do the Giro rather than the Tour de France, isn't he? But he's going to be someone to reckon with, isn't he?
Yeah, in fact, he looked like doing his best Jan Ulrich impressions at the Tour de San Luis when he showed up in January. He was packed into his suit and trying to really drew some comments from some of the peanut gallery there. But he, we were talking to someone at the team the other day, and they were saying how he had a death in the family over the winter, and he just wasn't training. He kind of wasn't really had his mind into it until he got back to Europe, and he's been getting that weight off. And in fact, this year actually he's going to skip the Giro and go to the Tour de France. He's going to be riding for the white jersey and seeing what he can do in the Tour. It's his first time, yeah.
Interesting. I mean, he looks like a nightmare, a real handful for other riders to cope with, because as we saw in Paris-Nice on the day to Fayence, he was right at the back of that group. There were splits happening in front of him. He didn't seem bothered at all by that, and then he comes storming through on the steep climb. The Tour de France this year, what's he like about in time trials? Is he going to be like this year's Nairo Quintana perhaps?
It very well could be. I think that he's he's a little bit bulkier and stronger than a guy like Quintana, so I think potentially he could even be a better better time trialist than Nairo. I think Nairo obviously going to be the better climber. He's kind of the climbing sensation of all these Colombians coming out this latest generation. But who knows how far? I mean, of course, the Giro and the Tour are two different beasts. I mean, we'll see how far he can go in the Tour. I think a top 10 for him is very realistic. And even as he says himself, he's very ambitious. And it's all these Colombian guys coming over to Europe. And they're all very ambitious. They want to win. They want to make money. I mean, for them, I mean, a lot of the Europeans now, a lot, especially kind of the Americans and the English, you know, we have such a different mindset about what cycling is. I think we can almost be more purist. Almost all the bike geeks get into it, especially in the States, you know. It's like this alternative sport. Whereas for the Colombians, it's like old school. You're coming out of the mines. You're coming out of the farm, you know, like Quintana. You know, they were almost literally campesinos. So these guys, they're all coming to Europe. They're all looking to make as much money as they can. And for them, you know, when they win these races, you know, they're doing it to make the money.
It is great to see the Colombians back, because when I was getting into cycling in the 80s, it was all about Luis Herrera and Fabio Parra, and they were so exciting, and they were, you know, they crashed, they weren't very good at time trialing. And then in the 90s, which was roughly around the time that you started covering the sport, there was Alvaro Mejia. You'll probably correct my pronunciation there, but he rode on the Motorola team. So, you know, what do you remember of him, and what do you think about this kind of resurgence of the Colombian riders now?
Yeah, I was kind of in between the escarabajos, they called them back in the day when those guys came up. We saw some of those guys race in Colorado back in the day, but that was kind of this mythical time in cycling. You know, that's when the sport was really internationalizing. You know, got the guys coming from Anderson and Sean Kelly and all those guys, and the Colombians were coming across, and the Americans, and this whole kind of resurgence in Colombian cycling. It's, in fact, they asked him the other day in the press conference, is it coincidental or, you know, why? And there is more institutional support at the grassroots level in Colombia these days. There's a couple of strong feeder teams that are getting these guys. And then there's the whole point of, it was the debate that kind of cropped up last year, was now the sport's cleaner, you know, do the Colombians have their natural advantage of being living and training at altitude? Now, does that come back to be an advantage again now that the EPO is a lot less of a factor in the peloton? A lot of people think that that's maybe one explanation why the Colombians kind of disappeared from, say, you know, those golden days of late 80s, early 90s, all the way up until maybe 2 or 3 years ago.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Last week we ran a competition to win the Garmin Sharp jersey signed by Tom Jelte Slachter and the rest of the team that rode Paris-Nice, and the question was, or the challenge was, to pick the top three in Milan-San Remo, and with Alexandra Kristoff being a slightly surprise winner, it's not a particular surprise that nobody who entered the competition using the hashtag managed to pick him as a winner. A few people did have him as third place, and so using a complex process of elimination and countback, we have decided that Cotilla is the winner. His or her top three was Degenkolb, Sagan and Kristoff. Cotilla was the first person to mention Kristoff making the podium, so on that basis we have decided that they win the jersey. So if you could get in touch with us on Twitter using the @HumansInvent handle, make yourself known to us and we will sort out getting your prize to you. Very well done. Now, sticking with Garmin Sharp, recently I spoke to Geert van Bont, who won the 2000 edition of Gent-Wevelgem, one of the first of the cobbled classics. It used to be held on a Wednesday in between the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. A few years ago they moved it on the calendar, so now it sits between Milan-San Remo and the Tour of Flanders. It's coming up this weekend, and I asked Geert what his memories of his victory were in 2000 and for him to sum up the characteristics of the race.
It's the most beautiful race in the world because I won it. But yeah, the characteristic is the wind normally plays a big important role, depending also where the wind's coming from. Normally it's a west wind, so normally you have a headwind from the start from Denza towards the coast. And then you come into the Panavurne. There's a place, it's called the Muren. So it's like very open, there is no protection, there are no trees, there are no houses. And that's for about like 20-30k. And then normally the peloton splits up in 3-4 pieces, so that's the first real crucial point in the race. The years before, they went directly straight to the Kemmelberg, but now they make an extra loop around the castle, so you go 2 times up to the castle on a different way, you do the climbing, and then you go direction the Kemmel, and then that's the second crucial point in the race. So the race splits up, and then afterwards you go direction the Ypres. And that's going to be depending after Kemmel how the race is going to be developing. So they'll say, I think you see two options in this. If you have 40 riders still together, it can be play an important role direction towards Ypres or after Ypres. You can have side wind again, so the peloton can split up again. Or You have 10 riders like you had last year, 10-15 riders having the breakaway. And then it's depending how they're going to be riding, and then normally you can make it to the finish line. It's all a little bit depending on which sprinters are in the background, which team's going to be riding.
So it's more about the wind than the cobbles, but how strong does the wind need to be to cause real problems in the bunch?
Well, you can do damage from 20 kilometers an hour. I see it every time, like if one team comes up, let's say our team, and we're starting to ride, and Omeha Pharma Quickstep starting to ride with us. Yeah, then you have 16 riders who's riding round. If you're sitting in 20th position and it's a side wind, you can keep it up for 1K, but after 2K you're exploding because you're having all the winds from the side.
That's because you're stuck in the gutter if you're in 20th place. There's no more shelter from other riders in front of you.
No, it's just you just develop such a big speed, like 60 kilometers an hour. And if you're sitting on the side of it, so just behind it, you're having all the winds and you have no protection. So you just cannot keep up with that same speed. So it's the most important thing is you just have to make a sprint before, and you have to make sure you also get in the echelon, and you can also have your turns at that point.
So it's about positioning and luck, I guess. But when you get to the Kemmelberg, then it's strength also. The Kemmel is a fantastic climb. The crowds get there from very early in the morning. They're all drinking beer and eating the hot dogs, and the atmosphere is amazing. What's it like to actually ride up that climb in contention to win that race?
Well, you're coming there and you're already like...
You're already tired trying to describe it here.
Exactly, you're already tired because you're coming there with the wind and the chalons, and you have to be focused so hard. You're coming there and then you have the crowd, so you're coming up the Kemmel. A little bit the difference is when I won it, we went down the other side with the cobble, so that was pretty dangerous. So it was really, really important. You were top 10 to the climb. Now you're going down on the sideway of the Kemmel, so you go down like with the asphalt road.
Yeah, it's like a little bike track almost,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's very, very narrow. It's very twisty turning. But it's from the other side when we went down with the Kemmel on the cobbles. Yeah, that was really, really dangerous. The problem at that point was when the bidons falling out of the bikes, and then it was wet, and you just take your front brake, and you just... Your front wheel goes away, and there were very nasty crashes with Hendrik Redant, I think Jimmy Casper was one of them, and was very. So now it's a good thing they changed a little bit of parkour.
Yeah, Casper's crash was particularly bad. He crashed on the cobbles and landed on his face, didn't he? And after that, they changed it. So the descent goes down the park through the woods on almost like a bike track. The race when you won it was on a Wednesday, sandwiched between the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. Obviously, everyone very keyed up for the Tour of Flanders, and the teams that didn't do so well on the Sunday, pressure's on the Wednesday. But now Gent-Wevelgem is held on the Sunday. It almost opens the season of the classics. Has it changed the character of the race much?
I think it changed. It's just like you said it before. It was like, okay, the big focus was Flanders, and some teams came there and they want to have a training, or they just want to avoid the race because they went down the Kemmel on the other side of the cobbles, and they want to avoid the crashes in that race. Now it's actually perfect. It's 1 week before Flanders, so you can make one big good test. Second big point, it's a World Cup race, so it's a lot of points you can gain there. So the teams have much, much more interest maybe than the days when I won it. I think it's a good thing they changed the race 1 week before Flanders.
And just lastly, on your race, what do you remember most about it? Because you were on the podium with Peter van Petegem, who is your teammate, and Johan Museo, two of the biggest names in Flandrian cycling. But what do you remember most about your win?
Actually, the thing was, I was coming there, and we had such a good and strong season already. I was like second in Hadelbeke, second in Kuurne. The team ride very, very well. Actually, I came there with the idea of, okay, whatever happens in this race. And actually, I was already 2-3 times dropped in the sidewinds. But then we only had one rider in front, Andreas Klier, was in with 25 riders. So me and Vapede, we decided, okay, let's start riding. So we started to ride, and more teams was helping us, and more riders was helping us. So we came back, and we were with 40 riders in the first group. So then we went up the first time to the Kemmel, and I was to Peter, you know what, I help you up to the Kemmel, and I see whatever what happens. So I turned up first in the Kemmel, and then I was still 10th on the top of the Kemmel. So in the end, we were in a breakaway of 12 riders, and I was still there, and I was second time, okay, I just go on the Kemmel and see what's happening. So I was still there after the Kemmel, and then we were, I think, with 12 riders in front, and I was there with Van Petegem, was my teammate, and Andreas Klee was my teammate. So we were the best represented riders in that group, And then Van Peteghem said, you know what, if you feel okay, maybe you can attack. And I had some friends in that group. It's better to have friends in the peloton than to have enemies in a group. So I was waiting for the perfect moment when to attack. And I attacked, and I have some friends who were like, okay, I go after him or not going after him. So I took directly like 10, 15 seconds. And then everybody knew Van Peteghem was the fastest guy. So they were also doubting. And that's why I won it. So it was pretty strange, actually, for me going to a race like whatever and then still win the race.
Well, sometimes it works that way when the pressure's off a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, sometimes it works like this, but it's like a race like Gent-Wevelgem is difficult. You know, you come to Flanders or Wevelgem, or this type of race is so much stress and so nervous. And like I said, I was dropped already like 2-3 times because I was sitting too far in the back. But then in the end, we had such a good team and such a strong team, and the friendship was so big. We were like, okay, you know what? We just start to ride and we see whatever happens. And that was the big luck, actually, I had that day. But first, you need to have the legs to be in the front group, then to win a race, of course.
And very lastly, then, who's your tip for victory this year in Gent-Wevelgem?
Well, we're hoping, of course, of Tyler, because it's a race that Tyler really wants to win. So, yeah, I put Tyler on number one, and then it's going to be depending on the weather, the conditions. So I think it's going to be maybe Tom Boonen again, because I think he's very eager to make a very strong and successful year. So he's one of the guys to beat. And then, it's going to be the same guy, Sagan, like Cancellara maybe when he's... The thing is, like, when Cancellara wins Flanders, maybe he's have less interest in Gent-Wevelgem. But when he's have a problem in Harelbeke, maybe he wants to win Gent-Wevelgem. So it's always depending on riders, at what moment they are and how the feeling is of that day.
Yeah, it's amazing how one race kind of sets up the narrative, sets up the story for the next one, and the whole of April unfolds like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like up and down, like sickness, teams, wind, weather conditions. You see it actually now with Milan San Remo, like teams make a decision, make a selection. And then now in the end, it's like the new climb doesn't come in, and then teams have to make the reorganization in the selection. And it's also about these type of classics.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
So that was Geert Van Bont of the Garmin-Sharp team, the sports director for the Classics campaign there, talking about Gent-Wevelgem, which is coming up this weekend. A race really which is characterised by the crosswinds and by the Kemmelberg. They're the two most notable things about it. And the finish line in Wevelgem, which is a pretty unremarkable stretch of road, but for what appear to be quite a large number of brothels on that finishing straight. I don't know whether you've ever noticed that, have you, Daniel?
To be fair, there are a lot of roads in Belgium like that. Gent-Wevelgem that I remember most vividly was, I think, the 1998 one where Frank Vandenbroek and Nico Matan were together for Mappe, and they did a kind of similar move to Sagan was in the group last year with Bodnar, his teammate, and Vandenbroek and Matan did a similar thing that time, so worked everyone over, and Vandenbroek went away for the win.
Yeah, it wasn't. It was a few years ago now when Matan was in the break also with Fletcher, wasn't it, Spaniard? And the car, one of the race organisers' cars or the sponsor's car, presumably driven by a Belgian, did seem to give Matan a bit of a tow, and Fletcher couldn't get on the wheel, and Matan won the race in fairly controversial circumstances. An example, perhaps, of hometown tactics coming into play there.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Nico Matan line, and I think my most vivid memory of Nico Matan is sort of, I think the last year he rode as a professional, he was about 150 kilograms. I think he was the biggest professional cyclist I've ever seen. The Mickey Quinn of professional cyclists, I think.
Oh, that's a reference for any fans of awful 1980s football there. When that happened with Matan and Fletcher, you had the impression that the Belgian who'd been driving that car would be given a pat on the back or two for having ensured that there'd be a home win. It's odd that it doesn't seem to be taken quite as seriously as the Grand Prix E3, which in recent years we've seen Boonen and Cancellara really go all out for, and then perhaps take it easier on the Gent-Wevelgem, or perhaps even not ride Gent-Wevelgem. Why do you think that is?
I think the E3 course is a lot more interesting. I mean, everyone associates one thing with Gent-Wevelgem, and it's the Kemmelberg, which is the cobble climb that they do twice. And you know, more than the climb itself, what people
tend to remember is the descent, and what the riders I think most fear is the descent. But the Camelberg comes a long time, long distance from the finish, and it can be decisive, isn't always decisive. And you know, I think people still balk at the idea of sprinters winning these races or winning sort of the cobbled classics, and you know, sprinters have tended to do well in Gent-Wevelgem in the past. It'll be interesting to see. You know, Mark Cavendish obviously has, to a certain extent, a score to settle after Milan-San Remo, a point to prove. He seems to be coming into quite good form. He certainly rode strongly in Milan-San Remo and has never won Gent-Wevelgem. It's had a bit of an Indian sign over him to date. It'll be interesting to see how Omega Pharma Quickstep manage or attempt to dovetail Cavendish and Tom Boonen. And Tom Boonen, of course, has an incredible record in Gent-Wevelgem.
Indeed. Well, we've entered a sort of a strange phase in the season now where everything's sort of split in two. One focus will be on the cobbled classics. We've got E3 and Gent-Wevelgem, followed by the Tour of Flanders, Paris-Roubaix. Meanwhile, all of the Grand Tour type riders will be doing the Tour of Catalonia this week, and then the Tour of the Basque Country, which is in the week between Flanders and Roubaix. So the season kind of splits into two very definite and distinct halves at this point. And recently I spoke to Andy Hood, Velo News' European correspondent based in Spain, to get a little bit of a steer on the character of those two races, the Tour of Catalonia and the Tour of the Basque Country.
Yeah, I think it's good that Catalonia now is in March, because it was kind of overshadowed, you know, it was May. No one really paid attention to it. In fact, Catalonia, it's the oldest stage race in Spain, older than the Vuelta, older than the Basque Country Tour. It's a good little race. I mean, it's a great race to go as a journalist, because almost no one goes there. It's really easy to do interviews. And this year, all the big guns are going to be there. They got a great field, Contador, Van Garen, you know, Froome, all those guys are going to be there. And it's always a race, you know, that comes down and it punches into the Pyrenees and Andorra, you know, it's kind of just a traditional one-week race. It's not really that hard a race in terms of, but the intensity will be higher this year, I think, with some of those bigger names there. Whereas the Basque Country Tour, I mean, almost everybody universally agrees says that is the hardest race of the year. That's not a Grand Tour. Everyone says that race is just brutal. I mean, it's up and down every day. There's usually 5, 6, 7 rated cols, kind of these short, punchy climbs. And the roads in the Basque Country are just brutally steep. They're all these short, narrow, really steep climbs, you know, 10, 15, 20% grades. Weather's usually pretty bad there, and everyone you talk to there says, if you know, if you're coming out of that race strong, you're going to do really well in the Ardennes.
So Catalonia obviously goes pretty close to, if not to, Girona, doesn't it? So I mean, that's the kind of the European, the beating heart almost now of cycling, isn't it? So many riders live there. There's longer, more sort of sustained climbing there because they go up into the Pyrenees and touch into Andorra.
Yeah, typically the terrain there, it's just, you know, the wider, bigger road. It's kind of more Vuelta-style racing. And it's usually a couple of good sprint days, and, you know, GC's usually decided on one day. It's a good, solid week of racing, nothing too extreme, good roads, usually good weather. I mean, the riders typically like it.
And in contrast, then, Basque Country always looks very green. It looks fantastic. I mean, if for any race that makes you want to go somewhere on holiday, I always think it must be wonderful there in the summer.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I just drove through the Basque Country coming up here to the Pyrenees, and, you know, it really does almost feel like a separate country, because you're coming across the Spanish Altiplano, and you just get these massive mountains that just drop right into the sea there. And it has this unique, I mean, it's kind of the hotbed of cycling in Spain. That's where all the young amateurs and pros come out of there. Almost all the Spanish guys that are pros race as juniors and amateurs in the Basque Country. In fact, Samuel Sanchez was, you know, always well known as the only guy who was not Basque native to ride for Euskaltel, but he was like an adopted son because he was from nearby Asturias, which is about 300 k's down the road. He, you know, basically moved there when he was about 12 years old and raced as an amateur guy, came through the whole Euskaltel program. So it's really kind of the Tuscany, you know, or the Flanders of you know, of European hotbed. It's like when the fans are always out, doesn't matter if it's raining or windy or snowy, and then there's always the great tapas and vinos after the race.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. The food as well, lots of sort of rich, meaty stuff appeals to me. The Basque country as well, you say, you know, almost a separate country, that's probably how they like it as well. But in terms of the crowds that turn out, you say that Spanish cycling, perhaps commercially, is suffering at the moment. But it does seem to me recently the trend has been for bigger crowds at the Spanish races. What's that all about?
Yeah, I think they're kind of, you know, the races, especially the Vuelta, you know, they're just done, you know, using a little bit of imagination to make the races more interesting. They're also bringing the races to smaller towns. You know, 10 or 15 years ago, the Vuelta was basically held on highways between major cities, and everyone just got pissed off about it. The motorists hated it. All the people who lived in the big cities would go from Zaragoza to Rioja or whatever, and, you know, it just blocked up the cities every day, and people hated it. So now, 3, 4, 5 years ago, they started taking it to España Profunda, taking them into these smaller towns like, you know, like you see in Torreno or even the Tour. And the people there, then, you know, when it does come to a small town, it's a big event. Everyone turns out for it. The fans are out. The kids are out of school. And also, you're also seeing more crowds at the Vuelta since they moved it back a couple weeks, because it kind of tails into the last week or two of the summer vacations in Spain. So a lot of holidaymakers are still there. So when the race goes through the Costa del Sol, you know, a lot of Dutch and German people that are on holidays will just come watch the race. A lot of Brits as well.
you make a good point there, because the Giro has always been really good at going to small places, attractive little places, making the country look very appealing. You're absolutely right. Throughout the 2000s, the Vuelta just struck me as always being really kind of brown and held on almost motorways. I remember, you know, it's like the backdrop in a sort of cartoon where you see the same bit of tumbleweed, you know, in the background, you know, as roadrunners running along. There's been some shockers, like time trials held on dual carriageways with just cones. I mean, the last couple of years, you're right, they really do seem to have made an effort to showcase the country. And you look at the TV coverage and think, you know, what a wonderful place a lot of this is.
Well, I think a lot of that has to do with ASO buying it. You know, they bought it 4 or 5 years ago. So they're the ones right away. It's like, okay, what can we do to the Vuelta? Create more interest. And the Vuelta, I mean, rumor has it actually makes a little money now, whereas before it wasn't.
Well, without ASO, would it be fair to say it wouldn't be here now?
I think they'd have a hard time, huh? Because the sponsors, a lot of the sponsors at the Vuelta are actually tour sponsors, that they kind of expand the package, and you see Cofidis and Skoda and some of the other sponsors on the Tour de France are actually behind the Vuelta. So yeah, who knows? I mean, there's also this talk of shortening the stage races with this. They're doing this revision of cycling's calendar. The Vuelta director insists that's not going to happen now, because even the Vuelta thought, well, maybe it's not a bad idea to have the Vuelta 3 weekends long instead of 4 weekends long. But now they seem pretty committed to defending, you know, the Grand Tour idea, both for the Giro and the Vuelta, which I think is a good thing. I mean, if you take away a week out of these Grand Tours, then they're not Grand Tours anymore.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
Well, we're off to see the Pantani film very shortly, and we'll have our thoughts on that at the end of the show. But before that, it's back to Andy Hood again to hear about the state of cycling in Spain at the moment, particularly the resurgence of Alberto Contador, who won the Tirreno Adriatico recently, and the rumbling news of Fernando Alonso's team. The Formula One world champion is strongly rumoured to be setting up a professional cycling team, and it will be a shot in the arm for Spanish cycling, although, as Andy reveals, it may well be backed by a Middle Eastern company. Thinking of Spanish cycling, you've got your finger on the pulse there. What sort of winter has it been for Spanish cycling in general, and for Alberto Contador in particular, and where's he at the moment in kind of his curve towards the Tour de France?
Yeah, and in terms of the big picture, Spanish cycling, you know, they're suffering through la crisis, is what they're, you know, a crisis. You know, the bottom fell out of the economy there in 2008, 2009. It just keeps getting worse. And so that's obviously hitting this sport quite hard. I mean, you're seeing all these teams close down. Euskaltel closed. Now the only big team left is Movistar, and you got Caja Rural at the pro continental level, and that's it. And the glory days of Spanish cycling are gone. There's only 2 big teams. A lot of the races are closing down because the sport was really subsidized by regional and local governments, especially the stage races, all these little kind of week-long stage races. A lot of those are really on the ropes, like even like the Vuelta País Vasco and the Vuelta a Catalunya. I mean, the Catalunya race had to be saved by the UCI 2 years ago. They had to pay $250,000 to at least to have them pull off even that race. So in the macro level, Spanish cycling is really suffering. But at the micro level, in terms of the level of competitors, it's probably, you know, it's as good as it is now as it has been since the Indurain days. I mean, you got Contador, Rodriguez, Valverde, so many good riders right now. So it's kind of like this contrast between, you know, it's tough times in the peloton, but for Spanish cycling, they're doing really quite well right now.
You mentioned there Movistar being the big Spanish team, the only top level Spanish team now. Is it the case that if that sponsor wasn't a kind of Europe-wide, you know, more international sponsor with business interests and links with other telecommunications companies, do you think, you know, if they'd had a Spanish domestic sponsor, they might have gone under as well? I mean, is that really the only thing that kind of saved that team?
Yeah, it sure seems like, because I know that Movistar, you know, they're big, especially in Latin America, and they had a development team there for a while as well under the Movistar name. And, you know, they're bringing in kind of a pipeline for some of these Latin American riders. And, yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for that international element of that company, you know, there might not be any Spanish sponsors. You know, we're talking about Alonso stepping in to get a pro team up for next year. But even, you know, his sponsor is supposedly Air Emirates, you know, so there's not a lot of money in Spain right now to sponsor a bike team at any level.
I spoke to Andrew McQuaid, who's an agent to quite a lot of the sort of top riders, certainly a lot of the English-speaking riders. I saw him at Paris-Nice, and he said that the transfer market, although it's very early days in the sort of the progress of how the transfer market goes, he said that everything is almost like stopped, waiting for what happens with Alonso's team. I guess there's a lot of people looking at that interest with a lot of interest, because if the sponsor is who you say it may be, that's likely to be a team with a big budget. It will have Fernando Alonso, who's a, you know, world-renowned sportsman from Formula One. So it will already have a big profile. What do you think are the chances of that coming off and being in the peloton in 2015?
Yeah, it's interesting. You're getting kind of some mixed signals there, because, you know, publicly Alonso is saying that everything's good to go. They're going to have an official unveiling during the tour this summer. Then everything's good to go. But then behind the scenes, you know, talking to some people, saying, "Well, you know, here we are into March already, and it sounds like there's not really a done deal. Maybe it is, but maybe it's not." Because even Alonso was at the Tour of Dubai in early February, and he refused to speak to journalists. I mean, I was there, and some of the Chiro was there. He would refuse to say anything about it, and the big rumor was he was there to finalize the deal. A lot of times that information gets leaked out. I mean, it's a small world we live in. But, you know, we haven't heard anything. That, in fact, they are chasing riders, and a lot of these guys that were supposedly being linked to Alonso, you know, you see them kind of covering their bases and going for some other teams. But you're right. I mean, if that team comes through, it's going to dramatically alter the freelance market, you know, the free agent market, because the salaries would be like another salary war. Like last year, you saw Horner, poor guy, won the Vuelta a España. I mean, even though he's 41, whatever he was, had he won that race a year earlier, he could have named his price, because everyone was fighting for points. Now we have lesser, you know, fewer teams in the World Tour. And last year, his points didn't mean anything, so he could barely even find a job.
You mentioned the sort of the clamour. There'll be plenty of people who want to ride for a team led by Alonso, particularly if they have a big international sponsor. But I'm imagining that Alberto Contador would be their number one choice for somebody to lead that team. And from Contador's point of view, it hasn't been the easiest relationship with Mr. Tinkoff already, has it?
Yeah, we'll see what Alberto has to say about that. I mean, Alberto's very cautious. I mean, I think a lot of guys, you know, say like Alberto, I mean, he's got his little team around him with Rees at Tinkoff. I mean, he says publicly that he and Tinkoff have patched things up. They both kind of had said comments that, yeah, that was just, you know, some tension there last year's tour or whatever. Maybe Tinkoff playing some mind games. But they said they're all on the same page going into 2014. And, you know, Alberto's got his massage therapist there. He's got his mechanics. He's got all his riders. He's got all the people around him. So if Contador goes to any team, he's going to bring all those people with him. So that's, you know, of course, maybe Alonso would be the only guy that had that kind of money to buy that away. But Contador has one more year with Rees on his contract. He has his deal with Specialized. I think a lot of these bigger guys, you know, a big established star, you know, I think they're cautious about going to a new startup team, because there's always hiccups. Things always go wrong. We saw even with Team Sky, their first season was kind of a disaster in a lot of ways. So a guy like Contador, I don't think he's going to risk, you know, changing ships midstream, because he needs to have a good tour this year and have a good solid base. He's not going to risk, I think, trying to mess up what is the foundation he's built up at Tinkoff.
How do you see him as a threat in the Tour. Do you think, we don't know the extent of this injury that Chris Froome's had to his back. Obviously, it means he's delaying the kind of the next phase of his stage racing season. Contador, you know, he does seem to blow so hot and cold these days. I mean, what sort of Alberto Contador are you expecting to see in July?
Yeah, I think we'll see a better Contador this year than last year. You know, there's so many different versions of what happened to Contador last year. I mean, you know, a lot of people say, well, gee, you know, he obviously, he's not eating the same steaks as he was before. But, you know, he came off that band and he won that Vuelta, and he also won that Giro when, you know, he was under that little kind of in-between zone there where he was waiting for his band to play out. There's no, you know, you can't imagine that he'd be playing with fire under those circumstances. So I think it's unfair sometimes to say people like Contador, you know, he can't win in today's peloton, because he has. He's won two Grand Tours. He got one disqualified, but he won that Vuelta. And in last year's Tour, you know, he'd just see Contador was on the back seat right from the go. I mean, I think he knew it going into the race. But, you know, the great thing about Contador is they kept fighting all the way to the end. I mean, they really threw everything they had at Froome, and because they knew they weren't going to beat him going uphill. So they tried to beat him in the crosswinds, they tried to beat him on the downhills, they tried to beat him attacking and destabilizing him. And I thought it's made for a much more interesting Tour. I mean, without that, it would have just been a steamroll all the way to Paris for Team Sky. So that just proves, again, that Contador is a fighter. He'll always fight to the end. And if Contador comes into this year's Tour, kind of like the Contador people are used to seeing, I think it could actually make for a great show. Everyone's talking about, especially Nibali coming in, focused on the Tour. I think it's going to be actually a fantastic Tour, because those three guys are all being at a very good level.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Well, we're out of Channel 4's little screening room. We've watched Pantani, the documentary about the life, career and death of Marco Pantani. Daniel, we've been asked not to give a full review yet, because the film's not out until May time, when the Giro d'Italia is on. It's going to have quite a wide release in cinemas, I gather. But what was your sort of snap judgment, first impressions of the film Pantani?
I think much like the Armstrong Lie, Lionel, it was quite ambitious. Well, any attempt to cover such a broad story is very ambitious. I mean, we sort of forget how many strands there were to the Armstrong story, and how many different threads sort of Alex Gibney had to tie together with that. Similar with Pantani, really. When you set out to cover his whole lifetime, starting from when he was a very promising junior, really, as far as his cycling was concerned, and then taking it through all the way through his career, and then, you know, covering all the various doping investigations that he was involved with, it becomes quite sort of unwieldy. So the director had a fairly unenviable task from that point of view. I thought it was it was good. It's a good opportunity for a British audience to see a lot of archive footage, which has probably not been seen before in Britain. A lot of stuff that's been used previously in Italian documentaries, or some of it you can actually get hold of on YouTube, but most of it will not have been seen. So, you know, stuff like his amateur career, his rehabilitation from the accident in 1995 in Milan-Turin, a lot of that was pretty interesting.
One of the difficulties for the film, the point was made beforehand that it's been made for a more general audience, a broader audience, and of course when you think of who that broader audience is, it's probably people who weren't interested in cycling in the mid-90s for a variety of reasons. Perhaps they're too young, or they just weren't interested in the sport because it didn't have the profile here. So the difficulty in the storytelling is trying to convey the importance of someone to an audience who wouldn't have known who he was at the time, wouldn't have known his significance at the time. Do you think the film succeeded in achieving that?
I think to a certain extent. I mean, around the time of his anniversary, the anniversary of his death, which was earlier this year, of course, on the 14th of February, I can't remember who it was that said it. It might be Matt Rendell, actually, whose book the film is based. Matt Rendell wrote The Death of Marco Pantani, a very fine book about his life and death. And I think it was Matt who said that you really had to understand Italy, or you had to have been in Italy for a certain amount of time around when Pantani was in his pomp to kind of understand what he meant, and to understand to what extent sort of Italy and Italian cycling kind of has entered a time warp since he died and has not really recovered from that. But I think the director did a good job of making the riding scenes very dramatic. There were good use of sound effects and, Pantani versus Armstrong on the Von 2 in 2000, against Tonkov on the Monte Campioni in 1998. So I think it did convey some of the drama, but I'm not sure you can encapsulate just how important he was to Italian sport at that time in the two-hour film.
I think one of the strongest images of the film was quite near the end when it was the footage of Pantani's funeral in Cesenatico, and it kind of slowed down and panned out across this vast crowd of mourners who had turned out for the funeral. I think it was a shame in a way that his importance wasn't really conveyed that effectively until the end. And I think probably the other thing I noticed, as you know, quite a keen observer perhaps, that probably the broader audience won't necessarily mind, is that the actor playing Pantani in kind of the quite moody atmospheric background shots, where obviously they didn't have footage from races or whatever to illustrate the point they were making, so they'd have this Pantani lookalike climbing on a mountain somewhere. It just irritated me that in every single one of those shots he was climbing on the hoods of the bars rather than on the drops. And of course, you know, one of the motif of Marco Pantani is that he always climbed holding the bottom section of the handlebars and not on the brake hoods. And it's just that little detail that kind of jarred for me a little bit. And once I sort of noticed it quite early on in the film, it really bugged me all the way through, I'm afraid.
All right, Mark Kermode.
Well, we'll have to leave it there for this week. Packed podcast, I think. We coped without Richard, more or less, although we haven't managed to eradicate him from the episode entirely. Daniel, thank you very much. We'll be back next week.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.